We're going to get started with the emotions lecture, but first I wanted to ask you, is anyone still having some difficulty accessing the consciousness exam video that we sent a link? Okay, so about half of you haven't tried yet. I'm just going to talk you through the instructions, but a student was kind enough to download the video, actually, and upload it onto a Facebook site. So these instructions might be moot at this point. It might just be easier for you to go that route. But for those of you, I know Dr. Thiessen told you about Access Medicine, which is a fantastic resource for students here. SGU has an account, and if you are looking for concise summaries of information on any topic, go to Access Medicine, look it up, and you can get the most up-to-date current information about that topic. So it's a really good resource, and if this is what it takes to get you to use that resource to get this video, then I will feel like it's a useful thing for you. Okay, so go to library. The red rectangle here shows you where you click for library from Karanash. And then go to the Founders Library site. It takes you there, and databases and ebooks. Next to that is Access Medicine. And then on this site, when you get to Access Medicine, you go ahead and post the link into the search. Don't put it in the actual advanced search bar in Access Medicine. Put it in the HTT bar. And that should take you to here. Okay? So, again, it might be easiest just to get the downloaded copy from your fellow student from Facebook, but in general, it's good for you to get used to going to Access Medicine to get more information about a particular topic. Okay, so now we're going to go into the emotions lecture. Just to start off, I want to get some idea of your folk understanding of where emotions come from. For attendance purposes, anyone need me to reset that? Okay. Okay, so throughout most of history, people have thought that emotions come from anywhere in the body but the brain, but now we know that they do come from the brain. They are initiated from the brain, but it's always been a folk understanding of emotions that they come from different places in the body. Up until this past century, where the doctrine in medicine at the time, around the turn of the 19th century, was that different emotions reside in the autonomic ganglion. Bichat believed that each ganglion of the autonomic nervous system initiated a different emotion. So, you know, the ganglion that innervate the heart for fear and for rage and anger, the stomach, resentment, and for the lungs, grief. As you can see, kind of sighing with grief. So, it's not unusual, right, to think that, but we now know that the initiation of our emotional experience comes from the brain, that we sense information in our own bodies and actually from our own brains, our thoughts, and from the outside world, and that initiates the emotional experience. So in order to appreciate that, it helps to show you what we call in emotion research an emotion elicitor. And before I show you the emotion elicitor, I want you to just take a nice, deep, long breath and get into your body and start observing what happens as you go through the emotional process. Okay? I think Sarah's helping me with the sound on this, so I'm going to pause it for a second. Ralph, could we make sure the sound's turned on from back there? It helps when you have an emotion elicitor to get both visual input and auditory input. Now, you can elicit an emotion from just auditory input or from just visual input, but when you have both, it's stronger. And filmmakers know this, right? So they use this to elicit emotions in their audience. So let's see if we can start this again. Thank you. Okay. What was the most salient aspect of your experience watching that clip? Okay. Yeah, so the majority of you smiled, laughed. We have a good reason for that, we'll talk about. And what came first? If you felt a sense of fear, which the majority of you didn't, but if you didn't feel fear, you click C. If you didn't feel anything, click D. If the feeling of fear came first, click A. And if the bodily sensations came first, click B. I want to see your answers. Let's try again. Okay, I'm going to reset it and just try again because I want to see your response. Okay. All right, so that's pretty even. A lot of you didn't feel anything. There's a term for that. When you don't have, we'll talk about. So a lot of you didn't feel fear, which we'll also talk about that. And then, so a lot of you said the bodily sensation came first, and then some of you said the feeling of fear came first. So these types of things have been debated heavily for the past century in emotion research. And Just before we move on, in case any of you are still feeling a sense of fear or your heart still kind of faster than you want it to be, or maybe you still have a little bit sweaty palms from watching that scary clip, one way to kind of down-regulate your fear response is just to think of nice, calming images. If those of you who like scuba diving coral reefs, for those of you who like hiking, and using this imagery actually is a part of some therapies to help patients deal with fear or threat, just to imagine soothing, comforting scenes. But for now, the point I'm trying to make is there's many different components to the emotional experience. And for those of you who experienced an emotion watching that clip, I want to break down those different components. So you have the sensory input. In this case, it was a movie clip, so there was both audio and visual input. And then you have a feeling, whether it's fear, whether it's laughter, whether it's kind of humor, enjoying just a moment, because a lot of people find scary movies funny. So you also have a somatic response. So a lot of you might have felt kind of a racing, I really feel a racing heart, and my breath starts to quicken, and I feel a strong sense of fear, anxiety, watching these types of things. So for me, I'm very sensitive to that. But it's also, there's this element of cognitive appraisal. You know you're in a classroom, you know that it's a movie, that this is not happening in real life, and so your brain takes into account all of this contextual information, and you do a cognitive appraisal. And that's why you don't feel fear when you watch a fearful movie. I can really lose myself in it quickly in the scene, and just it's almost as if it's real, so I have a strong emotional response. Even when the girl's pupils dilate, I can feel my heart race, because, and that's kind of, you know, it's an empathy thing. We all have that, but I mean, to some extent. But the cognitive appraisal component, right, is the one that tells you, well, you're in a classroom, it's not real. So then instead of feeling a sense of fear, you might feel humor or you know, laugh, because it's not necessarily real. And some people might have actually turned away because they don't like these types of things. They don't like horror movies. They don't like willingly putting themselves in a state of anxiety or fear. So a motor program might be just turning away, closing your eyes, a kind of an avoidance response. Or might be, you know, like, a motor program would be the facial expression, or if you're laughing, would be the laughter. So all of those are different components of the emotional experience, and they have different neuroanatomical basis, which we'll talk about in this lecture. But the order in which these things happen has always been a matter of debate. And that started with William James around the turn of the century. So William James was a psychologist, and he can be credited with kicking the soul out of the equation in terms of emotions, because around that time, everyone believed emotions came from the soul, the psyche, they're metaphysical. What does the body have to do with it? But what James brought to the forefront was the idea that emotions are housed in the body, that we have a bodily response to an emotion elicitor, and that that triggers the feeling, right? Most of us think of emotions as feelings. He's saying actually the feeling comes from the bodily response. So if someone tells a joke and you laugh, then you feel humor, happy. If you're afraid and you run, the act of running, the bodily response, and or the heart rate, the physiological response, is what gives rise to the feeling state in the William James model. So again, the afferents from the body to the brain give rise to the emotional experience in his theory. And around the same time, Carl Lange came up with a similar idea. So it's called the James Lange theory of emotion. But it was heavily criticized by some of the most famous challengers to the James Lange theory of emotion, which again came around a time where people thought emotions were more the domain of the soul. So now he's introducing that emotions can be thought of in the domain of medicine in treating the body. But Ken and Bard came along and they say, wait a second. Our physiological response is kind of slow, is kind of sluggish. And we feel things pretty quickly. So, you know, if I see a bear, I'm going to feel a sense of fear really quickly, but my autonomic response might be a little bit more sluggish, is what Ken and Bard argued. And they said it's really nonspecific. You know, we know the autonomic nervous system pretty much responds the same to just about any big elicitor of the fight or flight, right, response. So it's nonspecific. So how can we have so many different emotions and this really kind of sluggish, nonspecific physiological response? How could that give rise to the emotion? So they argued for a different idea, which is the sensory input comes in, goes to the thalamus, and it elicits both the physiological response and the feeling at the same time. So some of you may still have essential notes floating around and some textbooks. They like to put the James Lange theory and pit it against the Canon Bard theory and say, James Lang said the body comes first, and Canon Bard said the feeling comes first, but it's not quite like that. In the original articles, it was the reason why Canon Bard are remembered to this day is because they gave a really successful critique of the James Lang theory by arguing that the sensory input goes to the thalamus and elicits both the subjective feeling and the body's response around the same time. But something is still missing. And the missing component is really critical because it explains why cognitive therapies work. The missing component is cognitive appraisal. So that came with Schachter and Singer. They were two Columbia psychologists in the 40s, so they were looking back at this history of emotion research and emotion theory, and they said something's missing. So you can have sensory input. Yes, it triggers the somatic state, but it is, again, the physiological response is nonspecific. We need context to make sense of this heightened physiological arousal, right? So the movie, for those of you who said it was funny, you laughed, all right? I don't believe that you weren't affected in your body a little bit. But that the affectation, a little bit of adrenaline you get, a little bit of maybe your autonomic nervous system, your heart rate, maybe just a little bit, right? You interpret it as funny or as humorous, right? Because you're in a classroom. It's not scary to you. But you still have a little bit of arousal. So they argue that's because you use cognitive appraisal to interpret your body's response. So they took students, Columbia students, and in an experiment, they injected them with adrenaline. So they got their physiological response going, and they varied two important conditions. Where half the students, they put them with another member of the research team who pretended to be a student in the experiment, but was really cranky and negative, criticized, what are we doing here? This is stupid. I've made $5 in so much easier ways, you know? And then you had this other guy who was a Confederate with the research team, but acting like a student, who was paired with students, and he would say, oh, this is fun, this is, he was kind of like happy, jolly-go-lucky, and he would basically induce kind of a happy mood state. So you think all the students had heightened physiological arousal, some had an angry Confederate, some were cranky Confederate, and some had a happy. So the ones who had, you can pretty much see where I'm going with this, the ones who were paired with a happy Confederate said, oh, this was great, it was no problem, I enjoyed this experiment, it was fun, rated the experiment as kind of being more positive than students who weren't given adrenaline. And those who were with the cranky Confederate rated the whole thing as more negative than those who weren't given adrenaline. So the point is both the cranky and the happy conditions had a higher, emotional experience of the experiment than those who weren't given adrenaline, but they had totally different valences. And valence means positive or negative, right? So the context determined their response. And Schachter and Singer argued that's because we use cognitive appraisal to interpret our physiological response. And we use cues from the environment to do that. How many of you have kind of been in this nonspecific, worked up state? And you look for something in your environment to explain it, right? So sometimes this happens, I'd say, with the menstrual cycle. Sometimes a month, maybe you just kind of have, this is more for the female side of the class, sometimes it's a kind of worked up feeling of nonspecific anxiety or a bad mood or something, and so you have to find something in the environment to attribute it to. We make a cognitive attribution. Or maybe you get in an argument with someone and later on you're still kind of worked up but you forgot about why. So you make a cognitive attribution, you find something else in your environment to latch that onto. We do that because, yes, the physiological response, the kind of feeling of bad mood or angry, aggressive, something is too nonspecific, so we need to give color to it. We need to give some sort of cognitive understanding of it. So we make an appraisal based off of cues in the environment. And this was a really important addition to emotion theories from Schachter and Singer, which again serves as the basis for a lot of cognitive behavioral treatments, which try to change the perception of a scenario, change your perception of everything going on in your life to kind of make you feel better about things or have a more appropriate emotional response. So, thinking about this question, just to test your knowledge of what we are just talking about in terms of different theories of emotion. going on here? Sorry, let me reset that. Okay. So there's still a few seconds left on the timer, but go ahead and click in if you haven't. Okay, so 46% Schachter and Singer. So this one is a pretty clear demonstration of the James Lang theory. Okay, why? Because this is Amy Cuddy's theory, the power posing. She just has recently been criticized a lot from social psychologists because the effect doesn't seem to hold. But the idea is perfectly consistent with James Lang theory, which is that if you put your body in a certain state, power pose, if I stand up here like this for long enough, I'm going to feel confident. I'm going to give you, you know, a strong voice. My sense of confidence will go up just because I'm standing like this, right? That there's feedback from my body to my brain, and I'm basically feeling confident because I stand like this. And according to Amy Cuddy's theory, if I stand up here like this for long enough, I'll start to feel less confident, and you'll start to hear that, you'll start yawning, that essentially how you stand will affect your feeling. And that is perfectly consistent with the James Lang theory. So even though it's been criticized, most people would argue that your bodily feedback, the afferent feedback from your muscles, from your viscera to your emotion system, does color your emotional experience. It may not come first. It's probably an active loop where it's constantly being processed. Essentially, information comes in and we respond, and that response then influences our feeling state. And our feeling state influences the response, and it's all bidirectional, and it's sort of a loop. And we're going to introduce another component to that loop, which is that our prefrontal cortex can actually shut the whole thing down, right, when it's not really working for us. So just to summarize, psychological theories of emotion, we have James Lang, your body initiates the emotion, Cannon Bard, actually no, the sensory input comes in and initiates, you know, a subjective feeling at the same time as your physiological response. And Schachter and Singer would said, hey, wait a second, you got to think about context. And people make cognitive appraisals, and that colors the emotional experience. But where is all of this in the brain? Okay, so you've heard the term limbic lobe, limbic system. Where this comes from is Paul Broca. And Paul Broca did not care about emotions. He did not study emotions. He was a comparative neuroanatomist. So he was just interested in the histology of this interesting part of the brain that was different from the rest of the neocortex. And he calls it limbic lobe because it's on the edge. It's a Latin word for edge, limbus. And he called it the great limbic lobe. And in Paul Broca, what constituted the limbic lobe was the parahippocampal gyrus, the isthmus of the corpus callosum, the cingulate gyrus, the subcolossal gyrus, so the subgenial region, and the subcolossal gyrus, and then the uncus. But what Broca did, actually I'll use the mouse so it doesn't keep jumping around like that. So what he looked at animals, and he did comparisons of the limbic system across species, from the species more remote from humans to species more proximal to humans. He's interested in changes in the limbic lobe across phylogeny. And what he noticed is some characteristics were absolutely the same. Corpus callosum is there across species and to humans. The hippocampal lobe is there. The limbic fissure, which is what he termed, or is the term that is for the anterior cingulate. He called it the limbic fissure. But there were key differences, and these are really important. That's the olfactory lobe was much larger in species more remote from humans. And the closer you get to humans, the more you get an atrophy of the olfactory lobe and an expansion of the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe. So why would that be? Or what is that? What is the significance of this? Why am I telling you that? So in your chemical senses lecture on Monday, you learned about the importance of smell for animals, that animals really use smell in terms of how, whether to approach or to avoid or taste, and primary reinforcers for animals and for humans as well involve food. But smell is a little less important for us, right? So for animals, what motivates their approach and withdrawal behavior are typically smells. So a rodent, if they smell cat pee, is going to go into a state of fear. It's very important for them. For us, it doesn't really affect us too much. I mean, we're not afraid of cats, but I doubt if we smelt the lion's pee, it would affect us too much. I mean, I haven't. But the point is, seeing the lion for us is what's going to induce a state of fear. Our vision kind of takes over. But so this important area in terms of making decisions about whether to approach or withdraw something in animals is kind of atrophied the closer you get to humans. And it's been taken over by a lot more prefrontal cortex, orbital frontal cortex, and ventromedial prefrontal cortex. So what we share with animals is, we have, for survival purposes, we all have to make decisions about what to approach and what to avoid. And that serves as the basis for a lot of our motion decisions and our motivational actions, is whether to approach or avoid. And when you get into learning theory, you learn, okay, when we learn contingencies between things, that this is associated with reward or this is with punishment, so we approach what's rewarded and we withdraw from what's punished, or we avoid. So this is still preserved in humans, but with a lot more prefrontal lobe going on. So what does that give us? What kind of advantage does that give us over animals? We have a lot more flexibility in our responding than animals. So if you scare a squid, it releases ink. It's just automatic, right? Scare a dog, they bare their teeth. They have these quick emotional responses. Whereas we have a little bit more flexibility. If our emotion is triggered, like this movie doesn't make everyone feel the same, it's different in every person. You have more control over your emotional response. There's a more distance between the elicitor, the emotional elicitor, and the response. And thank goodness, because that gives us a lot of room to work if we have emotional responses that are maladaptive, right? So it gives a lot of room for therapists to work with how can you change the emotional response when it's irrational or maladaptive. So we're different from animals in that way, and we have a lot more prefrontal real estate going on to help us out in terms of controlling our limbic system responses. So Broca didn't care about emotions. Papez did. Papez came around in the 30s. He talked about the same circuitry and the same regions that Broca identified, but he imbued them with significance in terms of our emotional responding. So the Papez circuit, well, I should say Papez was studying patients who had cingulate lesions. And he noticed that these patients had some disruption of their emotional experience. They had attenuated or flattened emotional experience. So he said the cingulate is really important here, and Broca had kind of identified the cingulate. I think this is the circuit for emotion. And he got some things right, and he got some things wrong. So he believed that the hippocampus processed the sensory information, then sends it to the anterior thalamic nuclei, the mammillary bodies, which then gives rise in the cingulate to the what is happening in terms of the what of the, what is the emotion elicitor? What is the threat? And the hypothalamus, which he got right, is kind of the seat of the autonomic nervous system physiological response. And so those two would come together in the cingulate. And this is the Papez circuit, the loop. So information from the hypothalamus and the hippocampus and the thalamic nuclei would come together in the cingulate and give rise to our emotional experience. So for Papez, the cingulate was kind of like the primary emotion cortex. And some of that has held true, but some hasn't. So there's some key pieces that are missing here. One, we know that all sensory information goes to the thalamus first. And the hippocampus is involved in emotion processing, but not to the extent that Papez attributed. What we know is that it's really the amygdala. that I think the roles that he was given in the hippocampus really should have been ascribed to the amygdala. And that came along with Paul MacLean in the 40s. So he talked about the visceral brain, and it was some of the same circuitry as Pepe's, but he was more interested in these two additional regions, the amygdala and the septal region, because they had such intense connectivity with the rest of the limbic lobe. So these are important structures too. And he had a little more evidence going for him because he was working with patients with epilepsy, and he created electrodes to insert through their nasopharynx cavity to record directly from the limbic system, from the hippocampus, from the amygdala. And what he noticed is that when patients had auras involving fear, that they had a lot of activity going on in the amygdala and the hippocampus. So he was one of the first to identify the relevance for this firing the mesial temporal lobe for fear, and he put the amygdala in the Pappas circuit. You'll notice in this image, let me put laser pointer, the medial forebrain bundle, which becomes part of the system linking the ventral tegmentum in terms of dopamine release to the accumbens. And so for pleasure, for reward seeking, when you eventually learn things, like food, in the chemical senses lecture, you saw, you know, how a dog responds when offered a treat, that they learn by reinforcement, positive reinforcement. Well, how that's encoded is in the system where, you know, when we have primary reinforcers like food, we encode their reward value, and we get pleasure from the reason they have reward value is because they're pleasurable, and that's mediated by the medial forebrain bundle, which links the ventral tegmentum to the nucleus accumbens in the manufacture of dopamine to give us a sense of pleasure for certain things. So this is part of MacLean's limbic system, and one of the key things that MacLean introduced, which hasn't proven to be as true, is that this system is somewhat automatic, he believed. He thought of it kind of as a Freudian unconscious, that he called it the paleomammalian brain. So in MacLean's triune brain, which you probably have heard these terms, the reptilian brain was the brainstem, the limbic system is the paleomammalian system, and then you have the neocortex, which is our sense of control, cognitive awareness, voluntary behavior. And the extent to which he believed the limbic system was automatic and outside of our control has been somewhat discredited. That the beauty is, as I said before, we have a lot of control over our emotional responding. And so MacLean didn't totally get that right. But he did get a lot of other things right and introduce, again, the amygdala to the fold. Now, that work, in terms of the importance of the amygdala, has been one of the most important developments in the past 20, 30 years of affective neuroscience. So now we know a lot about these networks. And one of the main people who've studied this is Joseph Ledoux, and he studied it in rodents, but a lot of it applies to humans, which we know from fMRI as well. So we'll talk about that research. So for Ledoux, the amygdala is the structure that mediates our response to incoming fearful stimuli. And to give an example of Ledoux's network, or how we understand at this point the fear network and the basis for fear learning in humans, is involves primarily the amygdala. So I'm going to give you an example. Let's say you and your amygdala are taking a walk through the woods. Let's say that you know this particular area of the woods has a lot of snakes. And you and your amygdala are walking, and you hear a rustling in the bushes. So you say, what's going on here? Is it something I should be afraid of? Ledoux has shown in rodents that we have a very quick pathway to our amygdala, that low-resolution visual information, in this case, let's say you have, you just look over really quickly and you immediately get a sense of, like, a start, maybe a bit of a freezing response, or your heart races and you think, is it a snake? And that happens so quick because low-resolution visual information goes directly through the superior colliculus to the pulvinar, the thalamus, to the amygdala. What is it bypassing? What do we know about visual information and where it's supposed to go first? Where is it supposed to go first in the brain? Visual information. You're right about the visual cortex. It does go to the primary visual cortex, but first it goes to LGN. Exactly. So lateral geniculate nucleus first. For most, I mean, well, that's what you learn in visual system, and that's true. For most of our visual information, especially high resolution, foveal, visual, high visual acuity, through the LGN to visual cortex. But Ledoux found in rodents that we have this quick path to the amygdala that takes into account very low resolution information and prepares us to act quickly. So we might feel our readiness for action before we actually know what's going on. But what that does is, so when it gets to the pulvinar, the thalamus, it also sends into the amygdala, it gives an alerting response, and we have some release of norepinephrine, and our brain is essentially on the lookout, it's on guard. Now we're ready to like process information with high acuity. So it has the amygdala sends information to the visual cortex, which essentially is going to determine whether this is indeed a snake or this is a stick. So the visual cortex is going to disambiguate the situation by using higher resolution information. So is it a snake or is it a stick? The visual cortex can determine that with higher resolution visual information, say, oh, actually this is a stick. I don't need to be afraid. I'm going to calm down. So that's the low road versus high road theory, according to Ledoux. So there's this quick path for low resolution visual information to the amygdala via the superior colliculus and the pulvinar nuclei of the thalamus to the amygdala. And that can elicit the hypothalamic fight or flight sympathetic nervous system response. And it starts to, but then essentially our visual cortex can say, wait, this is not a snake. This is just a stick. Calm down. But you might, so have you had that feeling where essentially something scared you, but you didn't know what it was yet, and then you look and you say, oh, okay, that's what this is. Essentially, it's giving some booster to your arousal system before you actually know what's going on, and that helps you understand what's going on. So it's like, pay attention, something's happening, and then you get the higher resolution information to figure out what it is that's happening. So that's Ledoux's low road, high road theory. And this is really debated. I mean, I read a really interesting excerpt from this book, Destructive Emotions, where there's this kind of argument between the Dalai Lama and this affective neuroscience, Paul Ekman. And Paul Ekman is saying, but our emotions start so fast, so soon. They're below our conscious awareness. They happen so fast. And the Dalai Lama was saying, yes, but you have a lot of control. And if you meditate, he believed, you could go earlier in the emotional experience. You could stop destructive emotions before they get too far. So this is a matter of debate. How much control and how early in the emotion experience we can actually control our negative destructive responses. So it's not clear. But here, if you think about the neuroanatomy of this, to some extent, yes, there's elements that are so fast, so automatic. But perhaps with a lot of meditation, with a lot of introspection over time, people can become more aware, have more control, even at earlier stages. And that's a manner of debate. Okay, another question. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and... Sorry about these useless timers. Okay, so yes, in this case, cortical blindness. He has what's called blind sight. He can't see it, but he's getting some affective response. That would have to be through this superior colliculus low road pathway because it bypasses the visual cortex. So this is just a summary slide for you to have later. Now we know a lot about this emotion that works in humans from Kluver-Busey syndrome. Well, actually it was studied in monkeys first. Kluver and Busey were two surgeons who were taking out the temporal lobes of monkeys to study the effects of mescaline. And what they found is that the monkeys, without their amygdala and without their temporal lobe, became really docile. They had no fear. They were hyperoral, putting everything in their mouth, eating everything, hypersexual, and they had what's called psychic blindness, which was essentially they weren't giving emotional significance to different stimuli. So the affective attributes of a stimuli were gone. So they might look at food and not get excited. I had a patient once who had this, but so she said she would look at art and not feel anything. Now we call it visual hypoemotionality. If you have it in the visual system, if you have it in the auditory system, you can listen to music and not feel anything. So it's a disconnection between the sensory system and the amygdala. So you can see something and not feel anything. But this was called psychic blindness in Kluver-Bucy terms. And in humans, you can have the same syndrome when you have bilateral glioma or head trauma, status epilepticus, which is constant firing in the amygdala or the hippocampus that essentially leads to gliosis, inflammation, cell death. So it's just scar tissue there, so essentially non-functioning cortex, and herpes simplex encephalitis, or after epilepsy surgery where you take out one mesial temporal lobe and maybe the other one actually is not functioning so well, so you can have a resulting Kluver-Bucy syndrome. But in humans, you also have memory impairment, sometimes language impairment, and utilization behaviors, which is if the frontal lobe is damaged, you might see humans just, they can't help but like use stuff that's in their environment. So if I see this, I can't help but reach for it and drink it. It's like they just go for the object affordance. That's called a utilization behavior. Or seizures. So other famous lesions of Phineas Gage. We won't spend a whole lot of time with Phineas Gage because you probably all know him. He was this poor foreman on a railroad company who got a big tamping iron through his skull. So this was the tamping iron. This was his actual skull. What happened is he was packing in the explosives, you know, because they're blowing up stuff for the railroad, and he put the tamping iron in and it exploded and went right up through his head, actually projected all the way through. And recent research has actually traced the trajectory, because he's a famous case, and shown that it went right through the ventromedial portion of the frontal lobes. And that prior to his injury, he was considered polite, well-adapted, responsible, but then he became somewhat erratic, impatient, and emotionally expressive. So he wasn't able to hold a job. He was really a good employee, and he was, you know, socially conforming, and then after the injury, he became very, you know, cursing all the time, not showing up for work, and had a harder time holding a job, and apparently just kind of wandered at that point. So it really changed his personality, and he's a famous case because there's so much documentation how damage to the prefrontal lobes in this case resulted in more emotional volatility and expressiveness and less control over his behavior. So that demonstrated that the ventromedial prefrontal lobe plays a critical role in our behavioral monitoring and our emotion regulation. And then Walter Freeman did I'm sure you've heard about the lobotomies. So he went and did ice pick lobotomies where he actually, with hundreds and hundreds of patients, in, mostly in psychiatric hospitals, schizophrenia patients, would disconnect their frontal lobe from their limbic lobe by doing this ice pick lobotomy. We'd actually stick the ice pick through their eye, move it horizontally. You can see here how the horizontal and the vertical to sever the white matter connecting the prefrontal lobe to the limbic system. And this would essentially make most of them easier to manage because they were amotivational. They would just be, instead of causing trouble, as schizophrenics sometimes do in a hospital, they would be a lot more docile. And he is very controversial. I think charged like $25 per lobotomy, went around in this vehicle and did like hundreds of lobotomies in mental hospitals. Even Rose Kennedy had one. But the problem was about 14% of the patients would die, and about 25% had no change in their behavior. So it wasn't exactly a success, but he was really good at publishing and putting his work out there. So this is kind of a summary of the lesion studies of the limbic system in your notes. And now we're going to zoom in a little bit more on fear learning in the amygdala. So in order to understand fear learning and its distinction between learning a fear and extinguishing the fear, we're just going to think a little bit about Pavlovian conditioning, and you're going to spend a lot more time in your learning theory lectures on Pavlovian conditioning, but it's important to understanding fear for now. So you have a mouse who gets a shock, and then the shock is paired with a tone. So the tone is an unconditioned stimulus, and the shock is an unconditioned stimulus. Why? Because you don't have to condition it. It's already aversive. And the tone is the conditioned stimulus because you have to make the tone aversive by pairing it with the shock. So if you pair those in close temporal, close together in time, then the mouse will learn to be afraid of the tone without the shock. And then the tone then becomes a conditioned stimulus. And so the mouse shows a conditioned response, which in this case would be increased heart rate. So in extinction, you pair the tone without, so you give the tone without the shock. So the mouse then learns not to be afraid of the tone, that the tone is actually safe. And so you can see over time in trials, a reduction in their heart rate. So that is mediated, let's say the shock, through somatosensory, thalamus, right? We learned about pain pathways, and it's linked to the tone in terms of conditioning via the amygdala. So the amygdala is the place where you bind the tone, right, to the pain. So it becomes a conditioned stimulus, and that USCS binding is done in the amygdala. And then the amygdala initiates the stress response, the fight or flight response, which we'll talk more about later. The extinction memory is maintained by the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, and that's an important distinction. So the fear memory is essentially not erased by extinction training, but you form a new memory, an extinction memory, and that's maintained by the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which down-regulates the amygdala. It's telling the mouse, you don't need to be afraid of this anymore, it's not scary. In humans, we see the amygdala responding in fear learning paradigms, similar to mice. So here is when you're learning to fear in red line, and this is during extinction training. This is the amygdala bold response, an fMRI, and essentially goes down during extinction learning and goes up during fear learning. And this shows that the conditioned response, the skin conductance response, is yoked to the amygdala activation, is correlated. And during extinction learning, essentially the ventromedial prefrontal cortex is active to downregulate the amygdala when the fear is no longer warranted, when the fear is not necessary. So again, the amygdala for fear learning and the ventromedial prefrontal cortex for extinction learning, the safety memory, knowing that something is no longer worth being afraid of. And so this is the circuit. We didn't talk a whole lot about the hippocampus, but the hippocampus encodes context. And we didn't talk a whole lot about the orbital frontal cortex, but the orbital frontal cortex helps us remember what to be afraid of and what not to be afraid of over time. But in general, this is the primary circuit for learned fear. And I want to ask you a couple of questions before you go in terms of, if you have a patient who has a new fear memory, a patient cannot form, so they're unable to form a new fear memory, which brain structure is bilaterally damaged? Okay, so now you have a patient who cannot form a new extinction memory. Which brain region has impaired function? Okay, you can ignore the timer, but I want to go over these a little bit before we take a break. Okay. Interesting. So 62% said ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Yes, this is the brain region which, is when it's impaired, and you'll see this in the literature now a lot for a lot of psychiatric studies, that when patients have PTSD, or anxiety disorders, like you'll talk about with Dr. Kirkby, there may be some impairment in their ability to regulate their fear response. And that's based off of some loss of integrity, loss of function in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. But when they're unable to acquire a new fear, that's based off of dysfunction in the amygdala. Okay, so that last question, when they can't form a new fear memory, that's because the amygdala is bilaterally damaged. Now, if it's not damaged, if the amygdala is just firing too much and firing erratically and firing when it's not supposed to, are you going to get fear? Yeah. What we would probably call that is anxiety. Because when you have fear and it's not when you have a sense of fear and it's not warranted, it's not appropriate, then we call it anxiety. Okay, so we're going to come back to some of this in the anxiety talk and the stress and health talk later, but now we'll take a 10-minute break before biorhythms.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.